you. My name is Beth. I'm an alcoholic. And as I was taught, I tell my sobriety date. My last date of my last drink was April the 16th of 1971. I was I was 1.5 years old. And as my sponsor reminds me and has reminded me forever, every time I have an anniversary, you know, it's like, yes, yes. And the reminder is that that's a long time between drinks. That, you know, it's just a reminder that all I have is today. And even that is not promised to me. It is contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. That's all I've got. And when I get it there, life becomes very sweet. It's almost like the Zen strawberry, you know, where the guy's going to fall to the tigers and he sees the strawberry and he plucks it and eats it. I mean, it became very sweet when he knew that the whole show was going to end. And sometimes I can get into a spiritual state recognizing the fact that all I've been given is one short day, and that is only here to the quality of my spiritual condition. And I have seen that there's direct proportion. The quality of my spiritual condition is the kind of day I'm going to get today. So it really has come to serve me well to spend a goodly portion of my early morning time getting on the path. And I know I'm off the path when my gut's all churned up. I know I'm off the path when there's something in here that feels like I swallowed quicksilver. I know I'm off the path when my shoulders are up here and that little tension headache is starting back there behind my eye. I'm off the path, and I've learned to recognize all of those little signs. I don't think I've gotten any wiser. I've just got a little quicker at picking up the signs that I'm off the path. And you all have taught me a few more tricks about how to get back on it. And, you know, and I think that that's a great gift to be able to do that. I brought some notes, and the reason is because I really am old. And I will occasionally I will occasionally have these mental lapses. So I find if I have, you know, this little series of notes, it comforts me. And I can glance down, and there will surely be something that comes to mind to share with you instead of you stand here and watch me scratch my behind or whatever I'm going to do. I said that I am an alcoholic. I am a member of the central group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Tallahassee, Florida. It's called 909. A lot of people refer to it lovingly. Gadsden Street. We sure would invite every one of you to come to a meeting. They have them at noon, at 5:30, and at 8:15, and noon on weekends are big meetings, and we sure would love to have you to come visit. And I was told if you don't think your group is the best darn group in the world, you might better find another group, you know, one that feels that good to you. And my home group feels that good to me. When I say I'm an alcoholic, I love, and Michael, thank you so much for that wonderful sharing that you did this afternoon of your wisdom and the knowledge you have. It's a great gift to be able to share that with people and communicate those ideas. And thinking about what I mean, when I tell you I'm an alcoholic, and I will say this, I've had some people come to me who were overeaters and who were Al-Anons and say that they were members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that the group they have attended has made them and has given them that. However, I find in the 12 and 12 in the third tradition where it says, and the thing that I was told is that all you have to have is a desire to stop drinking to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's not exactly true. That's not the whole truth, because when you read the third tradition in the 12 and 12, it says, we say to every serious drinker, to a serious drinker, you are a member if you say you're a member, if you have a desire to stop drinking. So there's a little bit more to it than just saying I have a desire to quit drinking that qualifies me for membership of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a hell of a drinking problem. I don't know about you, but let me tell you, I did indeed. And I needed a hell of a program. And that's what I found when I came into the rooms, although I did not know that's what I had found, and I did not know the gift it was going to give me. When I say that I'm an alcoholic, it means that I cannot predict my own behavior if I pick up a drink. I cannot predict what I will do. How many, many times I would say, I'll pick up the kids in a little while, I'm going to stop and have a couple of beers. Usually followed with the boys. Couple of beers with the boys. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, go dragging in to an angry babysitter, frightened children, or having gotten into a fight in the bar and been dragged out of the bar by the cops and slammed into the jail 3 days later when I go back. If the children are there and haven't been taken somewhere else. That's not exactly what I intended. Certainly wasn't what I planned. I cannot predict my own behavior once I take the drink. And sometimes I surprise myself sober, but not like that. Not like that. As a matter of fact, I'm beginning to share it more openly because it is rather funny. I'm a 60-year-old great-grandmother, okay? I have 12 grandchildren and last month became a great-grandmother. Anyway, I got thrown out of Goals for a bad mouth last month. I got thrown out. They ripped up my contract. And I didn't do that bad. I mean, they don't know what bad is. Honey, I didn't even have a gun. I didn't even have a gun with me. You know, it's like, they threw me out because I said asshole. I am so much cleaned up. And I was in absolute shock. I was just in shock, and then I started getting tickled. And I've been laughing ever since, but it took me a while to be able to share it. Finally, I told my grandsons. I had these marvelous, there were five of them that were born all at once, so to speak. Within a year, I had five grandsons born. They're all now 16 to 17 in that age bracket. Talk about fun. You know, when I'm talking about what I have now, what life is like now, oh my God, it was absolute insanity then, but now. Now, and they're so much a part of my life. It isn't just that I have them. I have had the joy and the gift of being able to form relationships with these people from the moment they popped out. Some of them, I was standing there with the Polaroid. That's the job that I was sent to, the Polaroid. I was one of the first that was putting my hands on these babies. Every one of them had been born since I was sober, and I was a part of the birth of so many of them. And I had been a part of the life of all of them. And to get one at a time, and I find the older I get, the less I can handle two, three, or more at a time. God. But when I get one at a time, and then I can have this relationship with a human being who's more my own age bracket, you know, mentally. And I was saying that my life was not predictable when I take a drink. Not only that, I cannot control my own behavior once I take a drink. I can remember so many times saying, this time, I'm not going to drink but one pitcher. This time, I'm not going to make any nasty comments to that girl I hate over in the corner. This time, I'm going to keep my mouth shut when the cop comes in the door. This time, I'm not going to tell him about his mama. You know, this time, and yet, if I've had a drink, I don't have any control. And something that I used to call the monster when I was drinking, I called it the monster who lived inside me. I've been through great therapy since I've been sober. I've learned to embrace and pull in all of these marvelous parts of myself. And so the monster has been transformed. I now call her Miss Boom Boom. And I love her dearly, and she is the energy of my life. Miss Boom Boom is really something. And I've learned ways to kind of keep her happy so that she doesn't just burst out to go have her fun. She needs to have her fun. And when I came to this program, if all you offered me was sobriety, I would have never stayed. That is not what I wanted. I did not want sobriety. A, I wanted to quit hurting. B, I wanted all this insane stuff to stop happening to me. C, I would have liked to have gotten off the drugs, maybe. But I wasn't about thinking of giving up drinking, and I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I thought I was just crazy. And I came in on the second step. I believed I was insane, and that the only time other folks picked up on that was when I started drinking, because I knew I couldn't control my behavior once I started drinking. That's when the attention of the authorities was called, was once I picked up a drink, my behavior could and sometimes did become quite bizarre and deserve the attention of the authorities. And I got that. So I loved attention. And another thing about being alcoholic for me means that if I stop, and I stopped a lot of times, it isn't that I couldn't quit drinking. I could not stay stopped. I couldn't stay stopped. Not by myself, and not with anything I tried. And believe me, I tried so many things. I truly love my children, and maybe I'll get to sharing later. My oldest child was killed. And as a result of that, I developed this obsessive, real nutsy thing about my children. I loved them, and I was utterly, utterly protected and enmeshed with them. And my fear was at the point of phobia, fearing anything that might threaten my children. And yet, when I began to drink, I would drive around town with all these little children in the car. I would leave them with babysitters I was not sure of. I would get picked up, knocked off somewhere, and not come home for a day or 3 days or whatever. And I'm telling you that, and it's because I was not a bad mother. I was an alcoholic and did bad mothering. I love them dearly, but this thing, alcohol, took even that, as deep and as crazy as it was. The alcohol took even that. And I couldn't stop. The court said stop, and I couldn't stop. Now, I would stop 2 weeks, 2 days, 2 months. But then I'd say to myself and anyone else that I could con into thinking that is, see, I don't have a problem. I hadn't had a drink in 2 weeks. We can get a draft tonight, can't we? Sure, sure. And it's amazing. I would tell you, men, I know that they have testosterone for brains. I'm sorry with that to say. All I have to say is something along that line. And I would say that and get, I'm sorry. Oh, baby, I'm sorry. Oh, baby, baby. I'm so sorry. And it took a whole lot of that. Now, I'm making a joke of it, and maybe I better tell you that there are times when I have considered that very seriously. I got here, and I said many times until I was able to see more clearly that I don't believe anyone in my existence ever loved me other than my children. It was the only love I ever knew in my life. However, I look back on how much some of my partners went through and put up with and still attempted to help. And so I think maybe I misjudged that and that there was more love in the world than I gave credit for when I got here. With me, that alcoholism, when I tell you that I am an alcoholic, yes, there was the personality change that you were talking about. I can remember one of my friends saying to me shortly before the end, God, Beth, you know, I just can't figure it. You, when you're not drinking, you are one of the sweetest people I've ever known. You are so sweet. But God, girl, when you are drinking. Now, these were people I was behaving myself with. There were some groups of people that I would behave myself and excuse myself early, and some of them had a hard time believing that I was alcoholic. Well, honey, I went to the bottle club down the road where I could drink and didn't have to behave myself. I mean, it gets to be a real strain when you got to be nice. This image management is really draining, and after a certain amount of alcohol, it becomes rather difficult, and you know it's time to move on, so I can go drink like I want to drink. And I was a party girl. I wasn't one of those who wanted to go home and drink. Every once in a while I would, but that was only when there was no other way. And that's why when the question said, do you ever drink at home alone, I didn't check that. I mean, the only time I ever did that was when I didn't have any other choice. So I wouldn't even allow that as one of the answers. Just like, would you ever drink in the morning? Why, no. I mean, the only time I ever did was when I was so sick I couldn't do anything. I had to have it. So that didn't count, you know. So the way that I had, and I've heard others that kind of get themselves around the truth, and it takes a while to see. One of the other things that when I say I'm an alcoholic, that and it's probably the worst part of it, is looking back over that hell that I came out of. And believe me, I have stayed sober all these years in order not to ever, ever go back to that. I have never stayed sober because I think something wonderful is going to happen for me if I stay sober. I have stayed sober. I don't care how much pain I'm in. I have stayed sober because I remember clearly what level of pain that was I came out of, and I don't want to go back. However, there are those times that come to me when I want to drink. I like to say, like old Wesley P., my 30th anniversary was last year. Next month, I will have my 31. And he said that as soon as you get your anniversary, then you can say, well, I'm in my 32nd year. So I'm going to say here, I'm in my 31st year. And what I had to report to you is what they told me early on, that for some of us, the price of being an alcoholic is that as long as I live, that insane thought can come to me. And that I'd better begin to learn what to do about it. One of the things they taught me was, you got to, first of all, let go of it, get rid of it, like letting the bird, this was the thing I associated it with. Somebody said that a bird can fly out and land on your head, but if you let him build a nest, then you got the problem. So if that thought comes to me, not to let it frighten me, to understand that that's part of being addicted to alcohol. It's part of a way of life, a way of responding to life that was as much reflex to me as a mosquito bite's itching to reach down and scratch it. It was exactly the same. Life hurts, give me a drink. I'm frustrated, give me a drink. I'm bored, give me a drink. I'm lonely, give me a drink. I want a party, give me a drink. You know, I reacted to life and responded to life, good or bad, with the desire to drink. And so what part of that means is that as long as I live, I may think of that. Now, here's where I understand the first and second step are proved for me. That's utterly insane. That I could desire a thing that I absolutely know, or at least part of me knows, is going to utterly destroy me. And is going to bring me back to that same hell that I left. And yet the desire will come. One of the greatest tools that you taught me, and it is the one that has worked, is to think it through. If I think about taking the drink, it comes to my head, and it always comes in the form of the blast. Oh, how great and fun this blast is going to be. The rest of it doesn't come in. You know, trying to train myself to associate both the hell that's going to go with it with the drink still isn't working, but I still can think it through. I think, okay, I have this desire for, what if I did take a drink right now? I know that's real easy and real fast. A drink, honey. A drink means, chug, where's the next one? That's the way it's done. And I never understood people who sipped it. Why bother to drink? I mean, why not just get a Coke? Why would anybody sip alcohol, which is a drug that's supposed to alter your mind, or that alters your mind? Why would anybody do that? Okay. So that's some of the stuff that I'm talking about when I say to you, my name is Beth and I'm an alcoholic. I guess that I'll tell you a little bit of what it was like. And I have found over the years that I see it differently. I'm a little gentler with myself, and I certainly understand a little better. I have had the great fortune of hanging around, and believe me, when you know, talking about being sober a long time, I have to say is that old saying that all you have to do to get there is you don't drink and you don't die. It's that simple. It's real simple how to get there. But the other thing that I do know is I have been and watched more people die, more people fall and die than I have seen stay sober with me at my sobriety years. That's a real scary thing about what's wrong with us and about how fragile it is, our what we have. And anyway, but the reason that I'm here is that on the night, and my first experience with this, I was 2 weeks sober. I was in Chattanooga, Tennessee. That's where I sobered up, and that's the group that gave me my sobriety. And I was in Chattanooga, and I was a little clubhouse, and a gal who had been in and out a lot, they told me, which I didn't really know what they meant, didn't really care. I called in the clubhouse that night during the meeting on a Friday night and said, I'm drinking, I need help, please somebody come get me. And everybody said, we are sick of Alice. Yeah. So, of course, I thought, yeah, right, why should they go get Alice? Alice was killed. She hit a gasoline truck that night. It exploded and burned down half the Lookout Mountain. And Alice never had another chance. The difference between me and Alice is on the night when my relationships broke up, that's plural, mind you, much in plural, when my relationships broke up, when I lost my fortune, when I lost all my money, when my children spoke mean to me, when I was terribly lonely, when I felt rejected, when I had lost everything material and felt like I didn't have a soul in the world, when my insides were torn up with that old alcoholic depression, which can still come to us all through our lives from what I understand. On that night, that usually in the midst of the night is when the pain is so hideous because there's just no one and nothing to fall back on, I didn't drink. It's that simple. And now the reason I didn't drink is because I did learn and did hear from you early on that what you got to do, because there's going to come that time when there is no power. There is absolutely no mental power. There is no human power that's going to keep me from taking a drink. And I have been there. I have been to that door and scream out to whatever God there is in the universe, God, you've got to help me. I can't help myself now. And that has been answered. Some of the most powerful experiences of my sobriety have been those occasions when I have screamed out, God, help me. I mean, sometimes I just fell asleep and didn't realize what a powerful miracle that was until down the road when I could look back and think of the pain and what had been in me just to get out and do night riding and how close I could come to danger by doing that sort of thing. So I got sober and I got a little education. and a lot of experience and a lot of listening, especially to other women as they began to share their lives. And with what I was learning in my classes, put together with what I could get of my own insight and what I heard from others, I began to understand a lot of the stuff going on in my life. And what I'm going to share with you is really, for me, almost a hymn of praise to the God of this universe, because I understand in a way that probably no one else can, because none of us can get in the other person's skin, how truly broken this soul, this spirit was, this mind, and how utterly impossible it would have been for this soul and this mind to put a life back together and to become productive and happy and fulfilled. I came into the world as an accident on the part of my mother, and something my father wanted because they were trying to avoid the draft. I was born a few days after Pearl Harbor was bombed. My father was taken fairly early on, and my mother has mental problems. One of the things that I found out when I was about 12 years sober, I was talking with my grandmother between 10 and 12 years sober, and she shared with me, my mother had told me that she lost her figure having me. God, I carried that guilt all my life. My poor mother, just to have me, she lost her figure. She also told me that it hurt her so bad for me to try to nurse, and that she had come to hate me when I was a little baby because it hurt her so bad for me to try to nurse. My grandmother shared with me that my mother, who was only 16, she was just 16. I was an old maid in our family. that she would not feed me, and that at around 2 weeks, my grandmother sort of rescued me and began to give me from a bottle because my mother wouldn't feed me. And that, as a matter of fact, my grandmother said that my mother had gotten to where she would start to feed me, it would hurt, and she would actually throw me back into the bassinet. Well, you know, I thought about that, and I thought, well, dang, you know, what kind of attitudes did I form? Like, honey, all I am is hungry. I thought that was normal and natural, and here I am getting punished because I'm hungry. Here I am getting punished because I cry. I learned early on, I can remember being very, very small, knowing that no matter how badly you're hurt, you better not cry and make a noise. Because around my house, honey, you make a noise, they give you something to make noises about. And poor little mother, she just couldn't handle stress, and she would kind of go off. She just couldn't handle stressors. And if I was hurt and bloody, even little thing, even for my siblings, as they came along, you better clean it up, don't let mother see it, because we'll all catch hell if mother sees it. I became the family counselor. I became the protector, even of my mother. I became counselor mother to her. I came to understand these many years later. I am not able to have any contact with my family now. I became kind of strangely, they were proud of what I did. I was a good kid. I made straight A's. My mother and father both had 9th, 10th grade educations, and I did really well in school, and I loved school. Oh, I loved school, and I loved to read the first, you know, one of the ways I could get away from the house was to get books and go hide somewhere, and I can remember being in closets reading by the little crack of light in the door just so nobody would know where I was, and read all day long, all evening, until it got too dark to read. I read and read and read, and I did well in school, and teachers loved me. And I got so rewarded at school, and I think that's why I did well at school. And I would come home with a really good report card, and my mother would say things like, you just think you're so smart. You just think you're Miss Pris. And I got to where I didn't want to excel because my mother got upset. And as I began to get a little older, and she got more upset over other things, I think, today. And as I got a little older, all of this stuff was going on, and I have to tell you that I was being beaten, and I was beaten a lot, almost daily, almost every day of my life. I was beaten, and beaten hard, cuts and just stuff. I had broken bones as a child, and some of that stuff is still hurtful. And as I got somewhere, and I can't tell, somewhere between 8 and 11, and probably it was about the time that I began budding as a little girl, and the breasts came, my parent began getting in bed with me at night. I'm sharing this because of there's just not many ways girls like me ever make it. You know, I just was a broken piece of clay. And in the years that followed, my mother told me later that after I got sober that she used to pray that I would die while I was out there because I just humiliated them so. And, I mean, there just wasn't any support, and there wasn't any love. I started running away from home when I was 13. I couldn't stand it. I felt so guilty because I was abandoning my little sister and my little brother. And I started running away from home because I could not bear it. I could not bear anymore what was going on in the night and in the daytime. And being told that I wasn't loved because of the things that were so wrong with me. And you know, of all the stuff that happened to me as a child, I think that's the one that hurt the worst. That's the one that I'm still not totally healed from. That I'm not loved because of those broken things. And around 13, I took my first drink. And about a year later, and that felt good. The guilt was terrible. I mean, I was being good. Again, I was captain of the girls' basketball team, the girls' football team, the track team. I was president of the drama club, the thespians. I was on the debating team. I was the chaplain for the prayer council of the school. I played the piano for the chorus at school. I played the piano for our Baptist church. I played the piano for Sunday school classes. I excelled in everything I did. I excelled. And I really was a good kid. Now I look back, straight A's. I was a good kid. But I believed that I was bad. And when I took a drink, something weird happened in my head to think. And it wasn't so much that I was all of a sudden okay. It was just that it was now cool not to be okay. And it was okay not to be okay. And I love that. Oh, it just relieved this pain. And guess what is the most addictive substance on earth? All of the research shows it's something that relieves pain. Well, baby, I had pain. And when I found alcohol, from the first time I had that relief, I just look at that and say, what else could have happened? There just was no other way it could have gone. And from there on to total self-destruction. I, at 14... Actually, I had turned 15 by 3 weeks by the time we were married at 14, ran away with a guy who was about 20, I guess. And and we got married. I was pregnant. And a first child, I had a miscarriage when I was about 4 months pregnant. And the next child, I was had just turned 50. I was over 15 when I was pregnant with that one and had that one. He was... a sickly baby, sickly, had colic and other problems and cried a lot. And I had, of course, married into the kind of family that was comfortable for me and familiar to me, which is what I had just come from. And this person said the same things and did the same things and hit me if I didn't do things right. And that was just natural. And I always felt like he's so fortunate to have a woman like me because I understand him. And lived with that. I was 24 years old and had been through about 3 of those when a lawyer looked across the desk at me and most of my hair had been yanked out here. Both eyes were black, but I also had the broken nose, so, you know, it was hard to tell when my nose was broken twice and both times both of my eyes went black, so you don't know. And my mouth had been busted and, you know, and I just had bruises all over me. And he said, did he do that to you? And I said, yeah. He said, well, don't you know people don't live like that? And I remember just sitting there staring at him as like he had started speaking Chinese to me. And I didn't know. I did not know No. I couldn't even tell him that. No, I didn't know. And that was the beginning of some awarenesses. And as I began to understand, some of that began to get a little bit better. But I was drinking. So what? I'd get hooked up with some pretty bad folks. And I'm going to say that got worse and worse, and I got with worse and worse folks. Because I began to believe I'm sleazier and sleazier. It was easier for me to make my living charging money for sexual stuff than it was to do the other things that I did as an uneducated, had a ninth grade education and a whole house full of children. It was I made a whole lot more money, a lot easier, and I could drink and use drugs while I worked. That got to be a problem too, and some of the girls I worked with at the end said they would not work with me anymore because I was going to get them all killed. I was going to get us all killed. And it's because I was making stupid, stupid decisions. And I was doing stupid things. And here I am alive. You tell me, I don't know. I believe at the moment of my conception, God had an idea. And that is what I have had to go to. When you said to me, the second step of this program, that God was going to restore me to sanity and God is going to restore me. That used to bother me. I don't want to go back to anything I was. Don't restore me to anything I've ever known. There was no place in my existence that I could find prior to coming here that I wanted to ever be a part of again. But someone told me that, I don't remember who, what a gift, that I can be restored to whatever it was God had in mind at the moment of my creation. Isn't that sweet? And that's exactly what I chose. That's like you can choose your own God. I can choose what I want to be restored to. And I think that that's what has begun to happen, that a lot of the gifts and a lot of the abilities I have over these years, I've been given the opportunity to go to school and to do a lot of things. I got married a lot, too. I got to go back to all that. Sometimes I was just looking for somebody to save me out of that hell I was in. You know? Sometimes I was so smitten with somebody, I just wanted to kind of be associated with them. And of course, everybody who asked, I had to almost say yes, almost. And that got to be a problem. Somehow this kind of evolved into a big problem because I so desperately wanted to be loved. And here's somebody saying, I love you, honey. Let's get married. Oh, God, that reminds me of one of my favorite alcoholic jokes. Two alcoholics laying in bed, both of them drunk, trying to get it on. Neither one of them doing much good. And one of them says to the other, you know what? We ought to get married. The other one says, God, who'd have us? Like, oh, Lord. Some of those relationships I was in. Well, you wake up in the night and you feel the pee running, the warm puddle getting bigger, and you're not sure whether it's you or them. And those are worse than just waking up in the morning. If it's all cold, you can blame it all on them, but when it's still warm. So I'd be married to somebody mean. Mean somebody. And somebody else say, oh, honey, baby, 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 I love you. Let's get married. I would. But I got this other mean one I'm married to. Now, this got to be a real problem for me. I developed a thing of just being real scared and looking over my shoulder all the time. Now, that was not, as far as I'm concerned, that's not paranoia, because paranoia has to be sort of psychotic, out of reality. But the way I live, baby, they were back there. I always had to be looking. I mean, they jump out of some of the awfulest spots. I mean, just when you think you're clear, you've moved to another town, change your name, dyed your hair, come out of your job one night where you're using a different name. I love names like Windy Shores. I think I used to pick good names. And come out of work somewhere or come out of a situation somewhere, and they'd be. With or without weapon. Man, life was exciting back then. And had to clean up some of that. And when I got sober, one of the things I had to do, because there was no way, I couldn't remember the names of some I had been married to legally, much less those I'd married when I was already married. And I couldn't remember their names. I didn't know how to clean up that mess. And so I got something my sponsor, the first person who worked with me, suggested out of the Old Testament, where it said that all you had to do to divorce somebody was to stand in the city, in the courtyard, and have a bunch of witnesses say, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, you know, or something along this line. Well, I did that. Fort Lauderdale, Florida, down at New River. I stood there one afternoon, and I divorced, divorced, divorced. And for me, that kind of cleaned it up. I don't know about the law. One situation came before the court. I'm trying to quit a lot of this stuff. I better keep track of my time. Yeah, we're almost there. So when I got here, what I had to do was really start from scratch, and the folks around me had to be very gentle. Of course, there aren't many alcoholics that are gentle enough and patient enough and loving enough to deal with me. And if they are, I would have run. I did run. I couldn't stand that, because then they'd be clinging and want to run my life, and I didn't want any part of that. So I'm pushing off all the time. I desperately, desperately needed nurture and love and guidance, and yet I couldn't bear for anybody to tell me what to do or to even get near me. Couldn't let anybody get close enough to know me. Terrible, terrible situation. And look what y'all did. You got me sober anyway. And you kept saying, it's okay, baby, just keep coming back. Keep coming back. You know, and when I'd bring up my dumb topics and talk about how the world treated me bad, you say, well, you know, that's all right, baby, it'll pass. Just keep coming back. Keep coming back. And that's the way you handled me. And I got what I needed. I didn't always get what I wanted. And, you know, that's something that I've learned now, that my pain, all of my pain today is totally connected to the demands that I make on the universe, and the demands that I'm making on myself, the demands I make on other folks, on God, and that when I'm uncomfortable, it has to do with what I am demanding. And there's a beautiful passage in the 12 and 12, and I don't know whether it's a 4-step or the 6-step, but what it keeps talking about that we were making demands that the universe give us more than was our due, more than was due us, more than was possible, demanding that. And then it goes on to say that if we're going to have any peace at all, we've got to find a way of reducing those demands. And for me, that is the third step, where it says that I have got to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand God. And, of course, there we had a problem, because the God I understood was very much like my father. Did a lot of screaming and yelling, and I hate your guts, and you deserve all the punishment you get, and here's another zap. And if there was one at all. When I got here, I was so angry about all of that, and I'd already tested it. I remember one night standing in my parking lot. I had lost my kids. Court took them, gave them to their dad. Never could figure that one out, the one who beat the oldest one to death. And I stood there, and I thought, well, I just want to die, and I'm going to curse God so I can die. And I shook my fist at the sky, and I cursed God, and nothing happened, and I was so disappointed. I think I was more disappointed, not so much that I wasn't dead, but that there really wasn't a God. I was that sure that it would work, and it didn't. You know, and all this suicidal stuff, a lot of the things I was doing, crazy living, but deliberately doing things that were destructive to my body, like taking handfuls or bottlefuls of pills and drinking deliberately as much booze as I could get down me to die and wake up in the middle of the night with my heart going ba-boom, ba-boom, and be terrified. Oh, my God, I'm going to die, you know. Remembering all of that. I don't want to go back to that. And that's all a drink is for me. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. And I heard it one night. Rarely have we seen a person, they left out the word fail, who has thoroughly followed our path. And I thought about that. You know, I don't think I have ever known any alcoholic who has thoroughly followed that path. You know, none of us can quite get it. But the main thing is, and I think probably the greatest thing that I have to ever share, what my story means, is I'm standing here and I have not had a drink for 30 years and almost 11 months. Good God. And I am still the same broken piece of pottery that came here, that broken thing. And piece by piece, God is just kind of remolded and reshaped. There's this really great story I love in Jeremiah, I think. But it's where Jeremiah was a prophet, and he was trying to understand why God was letting bad things happen to the children of Israel. And God just, instead of explaining, said, go stand at the potter's house for a little while. So Jeremiah went down there, and he stood and he watched, and the potter is, the wheel is spinning, and he's raising a vessel on the wheel, and as it comes up, it develops a flaw. And he works with it, and he works with it, and he can't get the flaw out. And what he does is he stops the wheel, and he pounds it all down back to the clay, the soft, pliable, original clay, and begins to reshape it, at which point it becomes a good vessel. I think that's what God has been doing with me. And I hope that's what God has been doing with me. I've come to understand the seventh step when I've asked God to remove from me all of those defects of character. A defect, all my shortcomings, defects. A defect is not that I have warts, which is what I thought all along. It's like something sticking off of me that's bad. We better chop it off. We better do something. A defect is a deficit. All you do is add an I at the end. That's how I can remember. It's a lack. It's a deficit. What I lacked was trust. What I lacked was the ability to love and be loved. What I lacked was trust in the universe that something good could possibly happen. What I lacked was confidence in myself, so I was easily threatened. My fear was horrendous. Horrendous fear. So in that seventh step where I ask God to remove all of that, I'm actually speaking a double negative. I like this. I like it in math and I like it in English. It gets spooky. You get into the land of the mystical where I'm saying, God, I want you to remove a lack. I want you to take away something I ain't got, which is really weird. So what I'm really saying at that point is I want you to fill in this hole in my soul. There's something in me really broken, really missing, and I need for you to fill that in. I heard that story about Michelangelo when he was working on David. Someone came, that beautiful statue of David that I had the joy of seeing in the Louvre in Paris. and said, "How did you do that?" He said, "It was easy. I just chipped away everything that wasn't David." That is what God has been doing in my life, I believe. And when these things come to me that are difficult, let me tell you, my husband, I got here and I was a year sober. I met this man when I was about 6 or 8 months sober. Well, we got married shortly after a year sober. Wonderful, wonderful man. Had 25 years sobriety. Why he would get tied up with me is still a question of how good that sobriety was. And that's right. But he waited till I had a year before he moved in strong, and that's good. That's real good. And we got married shortly after, and he developed cancer, and he died a little less than 2 years later. And I just couldn't understand, you know. I really didn't. I didn't know about God. Just didn't know about God. What are you doing here? And but I did, at 4.5 years sober, get my children back. When I wanted my kids early on, and I would hurt so much, and I'd have guilt, and I'd grieve, and my loving sponsor said to me, "Baby, you're just going to have to focus on building yourself and building a life and building a home so that when, not if, but when your children come looking for you, even if they're 18, you will have something to give them." And that's how I kept my sanity. I did start going to school. I got a GED. And I got started on a little bit of junior college, and it was after I got my children back that I went on and got that, and I got an AA degree. And after that AA degree, I went on a little longer. Actually, it took me 13 years to go from GED, from no education, to bachelor's degree. I'm raising 4 children. I am working 1 full-time job doing typing for a court reporter on the side, and no help, no income from anywhere except little jobs I'm working and raising those kids and going to AA meetings and going to school. It took me 13 years. I just, you know, I'm slow. And after that, after my youngest child left home, I went back and I got a master's degree. And after that, I was able to get internship. It took 3 years for me to serve that and to get licensed. I have since then taken many, many more classes. I find I have a hungry head. Never have I yet been able to muster the commitment to go for PhD, but I think about it sometimes. And I just keep taking classes. You know, there is absolutely so much to learn. There's so much in this universe to learn about. So I keep taking those classes. I have a good job today. I was sharing this morning, and I'm going to share it briefly and just before I close, that I've also learned to live with my gut, the same one that tells me that I'm off track. Can't trust your head. I can't trust his brain. This is the one that says, "Oh, honey, you want a drink? Oh, honey, it would be fun to go get those bones." And yeah. This is the brain. The gut is what I have to live by. That's what I pay attention to. The head saying, "Yeah, baby, go for it, go for it." The gut saying, And if I listen to my gut, I tend to do real well. And also, the big book promises that as we work through our spiritual program, that more and more this what used to be the hunch, the occasional intuition, becomes a way of life. We come to rely on it, and I have, and it's there. Rarely is there a mess up on this when it just you know. And examples, a few weeks ago, my mother-in-law died in Jacksonville, and I went over for the funeral, and I was there the night for the viewing and to be with the family. I was asked to be part of that family, which was really kind of heavy duty. And the next morning, I thought, well, I'm going to stop by the funeral home because I forgot to get one of those little cards and a little notice, and I may need that when I get back to work to get my bereavement leave. And so I stopped by to pick it up, and got there, and there was nobody there but this one man in the lobby there, and he was kind of like that, and his head down. You could just see he was in a great deal of pain. And and I just asked him if people hadn't come out, and he says, "No, they hadn't, and my sister's coming over here." And he started talking a little bit, and so, you know, what I do is I kind of help people talk, helped him talk about it. And as a result of all of that, I had a gift to bring that day, and I was supposed to have been there at exactly that time. You know, I really didn't need that slip of paper when I got back to work. But finding out that if I just kind of go with the flow, it's like the Itchituckney River. Once you turn over your will in life to God, the Itchituckney is that when you get on an inner tube and it takes you. You start messing around and say, "Well, I'm going to hurry step, and I'm going to get over here. You end up in the weeds where the snakes are, or you end up, you know, in that big patch of slimy stuff over there. And if you would just stay in the stream and let it carry you, you make a pretty nice little trip all the way down the river. And that's how my life is. This morning, I just couldn't get going. I was slow. Just couldn't get going. And I'm thinking, oh, well, maybe there's an accident up there or something I don't need to be in, and I'm just going to kind of take my time and do what I need to do. I intended to be here earlier. And got a phone call right before 11. I'd planned to be out of there by 10 or so. Right before 11, got a phone call. It was my boss. Well, I work for the state. And normally, the work that I do does not go on the governor's desk for him to look at personally. Normally. However, the work that I do does go all over the state, and God has given me a job where I'm able to have some impact. Let me tell you what, we don't just give in here. You brought that up beautifully today, Michael. When the book tells me to go out and serve, I'm a fully trained member of the Red Cross, and I love going out on these things. Working with the Red Cross and touching people is not just alcoholics who are suffering. And anyway, but my job gives me the ability to do that to a lot. Thousands and thousands of people in the state are really in trouble. And I have the ability to go kind of help them and make it a little better. Anyway, I write up things, press releases, and I get on TV and stuff like that. Anyway, this thing happens to be, and I didn't know it, something the governor, it's from his hometown or his home base, and he's very much concerned about the situation, which no one told me or anybody in our division until this morning when the phone call came from the governor's office, and the aide standing with the governor sitting right next to him wanted to talk to me, and of course I wasn't there, and wanted to talk to me about the piece of paper I had sent in, which was a press release, and wanted to, the other sheets, the other work that I had done that was going to back up that press release, wanted to read them, and so I was able. They had transferred that phone call to me. I was able to call back to my office and tell somebody how to go in there and get the electronic file that was needed, zap it to the governor's office. Well, you know, you just heard my story. What kind of miracle allows those two things to exist, you know? Really? Really? I mean, what kind of force is this that we're dealing with? I am totally convinced that it is so, that the power that's available to us is infinite. It is beyond our comprehension. The only thing blocking that power flowing through me and back into the universe is the gunk in me. And we have this spiritual program of steps that the whole purpose is to chop all that gunk out and allow that flow. And it's a sweet, sweet trip. And I really appreciate that I was allowed to come and stand here and talk to you and that you would listen. Thank you. God bless all of you.